welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road, and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight, we're going to memorialize actor Glenn Headley, who passed away at age 62 on June 8th, 2017.
Too young.
Yeah, very, yes. We know her as Janet Colgate from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but she was in a bunch of movies, including Don John, Mr. Holland's Opus.
Wait. Don Juan?
No, Don John.
No.
I thought it was Don Juan.
No, Don John is the Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie.
Oh, God.
Mr. Holland's Opus? She was Tess Trueheart in Dick Tracy. She was in the very interesting movie Time Code. She was also a voice in Babe, Pig in the City.
That is a freaky movie.
She was nominated for a Primetime Emmy in 1997 for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a miniseries or special for Bastard Out of Carolina. She's nominated. She was also nominated in 1989 for Supporting Actress in a Miniseries or Special for Lonesome Dove. And she won the Chicago Films Critics Association Awards in 1989 for Most Promising Actress for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
I knew her most from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And there was a movie that was one of those movies that was just on the movie channels all the time when I had a lot of free time during my high school days. It's called Mortal Thoughts, and it was a movie with Demi Moore and Bruce Willis and Glenn Headley.
Ah, okay. Somehow I remember that being, maybe I remember it from like some sort of like HBO channel guide or something. Or
it was on a lot.
I remember her from ER. She had a story arc in ER.
Yeah.
She's also a Monk, but I couldn't watch Monk.
I never saw it.
Like Monk the first season, and then they changed out the girl.
Right.
And that's when the show left me.
I think that's about when I stopped watching, too.
Well, she was a member of the Steppenwolf Theater Company from 1979 through 2005.
Wow.
Now, Gary Sinise started in 1974, so she was on board most of the way. And, of course, we know Steppenwolf from Gary Sinise, John Malkovich, Joan Allen, John Mahoney, Martha Plimpton, Catherine Irby, dun-dun, and Laurie Metcalf.
John Malkovich, who was Glenn Headley's first husband.
Get out of town. Mm-hmm. I did not know that.
They were married for like 6 years.
Holy cow. I think being married to an actor would be weird, and being married to John Malkovich would be also weird.
He's probably super normal.
Yeah, I'm sure. So the movie we picked... in Not in a Creepy Tradition, is a lesser-known, but I thought perfectly wonderful movie I had never seen before, called 2 Days in the Valley, suggested by Brother Drew.
Yes, it's a sequel to the 1990 movie Bad Influence.
Not really.
No, not really.
But we need to watch the movie Bad Influence again, because I remember that being cutting-edge fun.
Oh, God. We saw that in the theater together.
And then maybe we'll get the joke.
Ah, okay. Brother Drew, share your history of this movie first, since this is your pick.
This is, it's like a snapshot in time of the 90s. I saw this, I was living with my girlfriend and future wife, and this came out on video. We didn't really know anything about it, but we watched it, and it was not anything like we had expected it to be. So it was. It had a ton of people in it, including, I think this is the first movie I ever saw Charlize Theron in.
I think this is the first movie anyone saw Charlize Theron in.
Oh, okay. That would make sense. But it was really unexpected and had a fun time with it. And it's not an easy movie to describe. It doesn't really fit into any specific genre, but it's sort of like a... It reminded me of Shortcuts, the Robert Altman movie, in that it had a bunch of people who, in the beginning of the movie, you didn't understand how they were connected, but they sort of all came together by the end of the movie. But with more of like a violent thriller aspect to it. Sort of a hallmark of the 90s.
So for perspective, Charlize Theron, her first movie was Children of the Corn 3. Her second movie was 2 Days in the Valley. And her third movie was That Thing You Do.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, Children of the Corn 3 probably wasn't even a theatrical release. I bet you that was just straight to video.
I don't know. 1995.
So, Brother Jay, what was your first reaction? Had you seen this movie before?
I have never seen this movie before. Yeah, this was a weird movie. I wasn't sure what to make of it because I couldn't tell if it was... I could not tell what kind of movie this was trying to be. And so I got caught up in trying to figure out where the movie was going. So I had a hard time staying in the movie because I couldn't tell if it was trying to be Pulp Fiction-y or it was trying to be... And there's a lot of different kind of movies in this movie. And so I had a hard time.
Well, in my notes, Anna, this is probably not an original thought, obviously, since you guys both came up with it independently as well. But this movie had a problem because it was put out in 1996, and Shortcuts was put out in 1993, and I consider that one of the best ensemble movies ever. So I think that needs to go on the calendar. And Pulp Fiction came out in 1994, and that is one of the best dark comedy caper films. I mean, also an ensemble cast, but...
And to me, this kind of felt a little bit like that. Not a lot like that, because the characters were far more connected in this than they were in Pulp Fiction, but I don't know. I had some real problems with this movie.
Did you enjoy it?
It was okay. I don't know that I enjoyed it enough to watch it again.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. I was surprised how much I thought about this movie afterward. Maybe not about the plot itself, but about what made this movie. I don't know really a lot about the history of it, except that I took some things. I made some leaps when I was watching the movie about what things were connected. Like, for instance, there's one character in particular, Teddy Pepper is played by Paul Mazursky, who is just the analog for the writer-director of this movie. It's got to be.
Yeah, Paul Mazursky played a lead character. He's a writer-director himself, not necessarily known for being an actor, right? Yeah,
and he plays a basically one-hit wonder
writer-director. a washed-up director. Who can't even pay his rent anymore.
No.
He wrote and directed Down and Out in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, no, he's a real guy. There's a lot of really awesome people in this movie. And there's some others.
Well, to spoil the end of this movie off the bat, one of my biggest problems with this movie was the way everybody had an ending in this movie except for the Jeff Daniels character.
Oh, he had an ending.
Oh. Well, he had the darkest ending.
Yeah, it was. I actually thought this was my favorite Jeff Daniels movie. I was thinking about that before I knew how his character was going to end.
Have you ever seen The Lookout?
I have not.
That might be my favorite Jeff Daniels movie.
I think we need to go on a Jeff Daniels retrospective.
Did I have a defective copy of the movie? I don't remember Jeff Daniels' ending.
He was reading the letter from the police department?
Yeah.
About how he had to turn in his gun because he wasn't psychologically capable of being an officer anymore?
Okay, but my point, everybody else is at the end of the movie, except for him.
Because he ate a gun.
Yeah.
See, I didn't get that impression.
Yeah, everybody kind of has a happy ending. Well, those who made it out of the movie. Has a happy ending, except for him. He didn't make it out of the movie, I don't think.
Nobody made it out of the movie. The detectives at the end of the movie didn't make it out of the movie.
No.
James Spader didn't.
No.
Dosmo did.
Dosmo did. Teddy did. I mean, really, so did Becky. Becky made it out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so shall we set up the plot? I mean, we already sort of spoiled the ending, but this is a movie about the experience. I don't think, even if we're going to go through it all, but I think it's an experience to watch it, and I had a lot of fun with a lot of this movie. The movie starts out with the unlikely pair of James Spader and Danny Aiello, who play Lee Woods, who's a professional hitman, and Dosmo Pizzo, who is a Danny Aiello's character, who is like a loser character. Like, he doesn't see, like James Spader is a like psychotic hitman, serial killer, professional.
Yeah, Dosmo's like a washed up thug.
Yes. And they are surveilling a couple, an aspiring Olympic athlete, Becky Fox, played by Terry Hatcher.
She's an Olympic athlete.
Oh, sorry. She is an Olympic athlete, but she's never won a medal. She's always come in fourth.
Right. She's been to two Olympics.
Yes, she's a skier. And her ex-husband, Roy Fox, played by Peter Horton. And, okay, to skip a little bit to some, again, history, Terry Hatcher was nominated for a Golden Raspberry Award for this movie for Worst Supporting Actress. Now, to be fair, she was nominated both for this movie and for, let's see, and for a movie called Heaven's Prisoners, which I think is an Alec Baldwin movie. But Terry Hatcher wasn't the greatest actor in this movie. But I thought she did just as well as Charlize Theron.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I thought she was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She did what she needed to do.
She's typical Terry Hatcher.
I think we're going to find she was better in this movie than in her Bond movie.
we'll find out.
Coming up shortly.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, maybe because I don't really have any problem with Terry Hatcher. She was fine. I think she performed well. But neither she or Charlize Theron neither of them were be expected to carry the movie or anything. They both had very small but interesting parts. But, I mean, really, this was I was going to say this is a James Spader, Danny Aiello movie, but just to get back to the plot here. So we have James Spader and Danny Aiello who we find out, they go into Becky's home, inject her with some sort of sedative, and then shoot her husband, her ex-husband, in the head on the bed that they are both sleeping in. After he tries to have sex with her in a creepy against her will kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very, that was a very unpleasant scene.
Yeah, it was kind of rapey.
Totally rapey, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then they end up shooting him and then they leave.
Yeah, I really didn't have a lot of sympathy for him being killed.
No, he was terrible.
Then they drive to an abandoned area of Mulholland Drive where James Spader shoots Danny Aiello and then blows up the car. Before they shoot Peter Horton in the head, they interrogate him about this girl named Helga. And James Spader has this little shtick where he pulls out his stopwatch and says, "You have a minute."
That's the only thing I did not like about this movie, the 1 minute shtick.
Yeah, I agree. It felt kind of forced.
See, this is where I thought the movie could have had some potential, and it was wasted.
Well, the fact that Danny Aiello gets out of the vehicle before it explodes and ends up like falling down the hill and at the mansion of one of my favorite characters in the movie, this weirdo art dealer named Alan Hooper, played by Greg Crutwell, who I had to look up on IMDb because he's in nothing else. He's mostly a
Alan Hopper.
Did I call him Hopwell or something?
You called him Hooper.
Hooper. Okay. Sorry. Alan Hopper is the art dealer.
Yeah. He has some batshit crazy art.
Oh, and he's a pretentious prick. It's great.
Right, he's an asshole, but he's a hardworking asshole because he got there the hard way.
Look, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I spent a large part of my childhood being brought up in a trailer park. My father abandoned us, and my mother couldn't even afford to send me to college. I might be an arsehole, but I worked hard to become one.
Well, you definitely achieved your goal.
Yep, which is pretty awesome. And his harried assistant, Susan Parrish, played by Glenn Headley, who is great. She plays the mousy character very well, but in a compelling way.
Mousy, but very smart.
Yeah.
She's probably the most likable character in the whole movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that adorable Pitbull was the most likable character in the whole movie.
Yeah, but you knew that Pitbulls have a heart of darkness, so... Susan didn't have any darkness to her. Except she was wise beyond her appearance.
I'm just glad they didn't kill the dog.
Yeah, I was waiting to see what would happen there.
Yeah, because I was like, if they would have killed the dog, man... Somebody would have had some hell to pay.
There were a couple dogs that could have bit in this movie that didn't, so that was nice. Because I was thinking that Teddy's dog, Bogey, was going to bite it too. Because in the beginning, also, we meet up with Teddy Peppers, who's the Paul Mazursky character, who is, yeah, he can't pay his rent, and he is he's trying to give away his dog because he has to move. But where we find out quickly is he's going to move to heaven where he after he shoots himself. I may be getting my my afterlife mixed up because maybe if you shoot yourself, you don't go to heaven, depending on your religion. But anyway, he's going to be checking out of this realm by way of a teeny tiny revolver. Not revolver, sorry. Very teeny tiny handgun.
By the way, the pit bull, the real life dog, has a first and last name in the credits.
Get out of town.
Mark the Pitbull, Mark with a C, the Pitbull, was played by Mark with a K, Goldstein.
Maybe it's just a really, really, really little dude in a Pitbull costume.
I love the fact that the Pitbull's name was Mark also. like Bogey is a dog's name. Mark is a hilarious name for a dog. Yeah, so, you know, so we have this guy who, I mean, he is a pathetic character, Teddy Peppers is. He's going to kill himself. And, you know, he's washed up. And then he had what I thought was a great scene where he ends up bumping into, like, a guy he used to work with in the park.
Yeah, one of those guys who's been in everything.
Yep.
His name is Austin Pendleton.
Well, he was the best because he is, like, you know, Sergeant Exposition reporting for duty. But in such an asshole way that makes me think this rings true to Hollywood a little bit.
I'm sure. He's really sticking the knife in.
And just twisting, twisting. Oh, just kidding, twisting, twisting. Oh, just kidding, twisting, twisting. Yeah, you have a good time. So we have Teddy that ends up at the military cemetery where his mother, who was a whack in World War II, was buried. And he's going to kill himself right there. But ends up being interrupted by a nurse who is there to visit the grave of somebody we don't even figure anything about, right? We never know why she's not going to tell that story, do we?
Nah, she doesn't want to talk about him.
Yeah, so I like that.
Oh, I assume that was the fallen soldier that she was pining about.
What fallen soldier?
She talks about a fallen soldier and why she wanted somebody to make a war movie.
Maybe, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, but yeah, so they strike a strange friendship and she agrees to take his dog. But as he is crying, she tells him to get in the car and she's going to introduce him to the guy she's given the dog to, which turns out to be her brother, which turns out to be the art dealer. Oh, by the way, and Daniello has taken the art dealer and Glenn Headley hostage in his house.
The art dealer who was hilariously afflicted by kidney stones.
Yes, in a very funny way.
When he was stricken with them in the beginning of the movie, it looked horrifying. He was crawling across traffic. He was in so much pain.
Neither of you have had kidney stones?
No.
No.
Yeah, that's, by the way, that's exactly what it would look like.
Oh, I'm sure.
No, it looked bad.
Oh, he sold it.
No, he sold it. I cringed because I thought to myself, I imagine that's quite what I looked like.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have this fun thing where Danny Aiello's character is basically, he wants to just like steal the car and get away, but The police come, hears the sirens coming up the street, and because of the bomb, and so he kind of has to wait here till he can get out. And then, of course, Alan's sister, the nurse, and Paul Mazursky show up with another dog. Oh, he doesn't like dogs either, which is pretty funny.
Dogs don't like him.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, Mark tried to eat him through the glass.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
Although Mark just wanted to fetch.
Exactly.
But Dosmo actually cooked them up a nice Italian meal.
He did. And Susan recognized him from someplace but couldn't place it. And Dosmo has the best toupee. Or the worst toupee.
Definitely the worst.
It's great,
but,
though.
Yeah, but Susan reveals she has Italian heritage.
And changed her name.
Mm-hmm.
And it reveals all this to him in dismay of the art dealer who's her boss, because he's known her for 8 years and has never known all this stuff. But he is very self-absorbed.
Yeah, he's not the most observant fellow.
Yeah. So, but I like him. I like that character. I don't know how you guys feel, but he was an asshole, but he was great.
The creepy dog with his face statue in the bathroom freaked me the fuck out.
Oh, that was
terrifying.
All the art was great. But yeah.
But by the way, the nurse that was hanging out with Paul Mazursky, that was Marsha Mason.
Yes. And where is Marsha Mason from?
The Goodbye Girl.
Okay. She's a serious actor as well.
Also, she was in Drop Dead Fred.
Ah.
Course.
A movie that we would have on the calendar, except that it is unviewable anyplace, which actually has never stopped us before.
I do have a copy of it. I've been avoiding watching it, though, because I'm terrified that it's just going to be awful.
Oh, it's P.B. Cates. I'm in.
I don't want it to be awful. I want it to be good, because I can't remember. I mean, I used to watch that like 30 or 40 times, because I just thought it was hilarious. And I'm wondering now.
Do you think you've seen that movie more or less than the number of times I've seen Superman 2?
Oh, less. Less. By far less.
100% less.
I was going to say probably, yeah.
Have you seen that movie more or less times than you have seen Murder by Death?
Less than Murder by Death.
Okay. And Murder by Death less than Drew has seen Superman 2?
Yes. Combined even still less than Drew has seen. Drew watched that movie like every day for like 5 years.
Yeah, well, Drew grew up in that window.
It was not 5 years, but.
No, I mean, because I remember A.J. Achilles was roughly Drew's age, right? Mm-hmm. And he could recite.
He was a little older.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, okay. So he could recite like every single word of Star Wars because he watched that movie every single day. Like A New Hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we just happened to have it on video around the time when I just happened to be old enough that I could put in a movie and watch it myself.
Yeah.
And I was the third kid, so.
I had a lot
of time on my hands.
What I remember is you playing that terrible, was it the Transformer soundtrack?
Oh, yeah.
With the touch?
Yeah.
Later to be immortalized in Boogie Nights?
Yes.
Stu somebody?
Stan Bush.
Stan Bush, yes. You got the touch. You got the power.
Yeah. I just remember you playing that song over and over and over.
That
and
was
over
probably
again.
One of your first musical choices that you made yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the Transformers movie soundtrack and the Back to the Future movie soundtrack. On heavy rotation in my room.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, Brother Jay and I were older, so we didn't have VCRs when we were at those formative years. So my version would have been like listening to the Power Records, like Marvel Comics. Well, I guess it was DC Comics too. The Power Records LPs of the stories that were actually, it turns out, surprisingly dark. Spider-Man and the Man-Wolf is pretty dark.
Yeah.
But, and so Jason, what would it be for you?
I remember. No, I'm sorry.
You had
cassettes. What would be my?
I remember you had lots of cassettes of Because you had cassettes. I mean, maybe this is when you were much younger, but you had cassettes of like the Sesame Street stuff and then some of the weird parody stuff. And then, of course, like Urban Chipmunk.
I had Urban Chipmunk on vinyl.
Yeah, no, you did. But you had, I think because when you suffered the Kawasaki, you got a bunch of cassettes and a cassette deck.
I had like 3 or 4 cassettes when I was in the hospital. One of which was like a Disney, storybook, which had a bunch of like nursery rhyme songs that they had appropriated for their own Disney purpose. So they had reworked the lyrics in them, but just used the tunes.
I want to say there was some sort of like one of the duck families sang One Ton Tomato to the tune.
Oh yeah. No, it was very bizarre. It was bizarre. That. I had that a minute.
Sounds like a fever dream.
One ton tomato. I'd eat a one ton tomato. One ton tomato. I'd eat a one ton tomato.
It was that, I think. Was that? I got the Minute Work.
Oh.
Cassette.
Like Overkill and then, or something?
And then I got that, and I think I got an ABBA cassette. And that whole hospital thing. Because I think somehow your Walkman got appropriated.
Oh, I'm sure. But, I mean, and that then, was just, you know, that was a casualty.
But the funny thing being that Dad was gung-ho to, of course, Dad was rarely in the hospital room. But he was really gung-ho to come and install the Atari system in my room. And I was like, I don't want it. Like, I don't want it in my room. And he really wanted it there. And I think as an adult now, I realize he wanted it there so he could play it. So, cause it would distract him from having to look at like the tubes and all the stuff in my room. And as a kid, I didn't get it. I thought, you know, he wanted me to play Atari, and I was like, I don't even feel like breathing. I just...
Yeah. Well, you were preoccupied by being very sick.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, it wasn't a fun living situation either, because the guy in the bed next to me was... Yeah. So, but yeah, no, I remember playing like that Men at Work. Like, I know till to this day, I know every lyric to every song on that album. No matter, I mean, you can start any song at any point in time and I can finish the song. I could probably write them out at this point. Can't remember my cell phone number half the time because I never call it. But that's what's in my head is the Men at Work, the ABBA, and the strange Disney thing, which I remember bits and pieces of it. But predominantly it was vinyl. I mean, yeah. I didn't like cassettes because cassettes just seemed, I just didn't have good luck with them.
Well, I know we played a lot of like our parents' old I remember the red colored Chipmunks vinyl.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That was great, and then a lot of like Beatles.
Well, and I had all the Beatles. I mean, I very quickly adopted all of the parents' Beatles 8-tracks, and I would play yeah. those a lot.
The green, the white, and the red.
Well, yes. and the blue.
Was it blue?
Mm-hmm. Because it was the greatest hits. The greatest hits were the blue and the red.
True, yes. Blue and the red. And then the white album.
Yep.
My lasting memory of you in the hospital, this is still very vivid, even though I was super young.
getting a creepy clown doll from your grandmother?
What was No, the did that happen name? At the hospital?
What was the clown doll?
Bandy.
Bandy.
that fucking thing.
Yeah, that's
no. My I happened to be visiting with mom.
She meant well.
Yeah,
I think it was grandma. It was either grandma or Aunt Lee. It was one of the two. I think it was grandma though.
God damn! You just like changed my whole posture.
sorry.
I was visiting. Mom took me to visit you, and it happened to be the day you decided that. No, they were not going to take any more blood from you. And, yeah, so, but, the nurses and other helpers were not taking no for an answer. So you started like full on throwing a fit and not letting anybody near you. And I lost count of how many, they kicked us out. But I lost count of how many people had to go into the room to hold you down to take your blood. I was like, holy shit, he's got the strength of like 10 grown men.
It took 8 of them.
Yeah, no, that was, I think that might have been the last time mom took me to visit you in the hospital.
Well, I broke one of the nurse's teeth a different night, so.
But that was a significant data point in my young life. It's like when you're committed to something, it can take a lot to stop you, even if you're little.
Like me personally?
Well, just in general. Like if you really commit yourself, it's hard to stop you.
I don't know. Yeah, I had the nurses one night woke me up to I think give me a sleeping pill, and I was like, I'm fine. She says, no, you're going to take this. I'm like, no, I'm not. And then it escalated, and I ended up like fighting her, and I think I broke her tooth. So, because I got a lecture about it from one of the nuns the next day. I was like,
leave me. Now, you were like 7, right?
I was in 4th grade.
Okay, so you were older than that.
So like 9?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Well, I was exhausted. I didn't feel good. I didn't know what was going on. Nobody knew what was going on. You know, I was in a strange place. I had 3 different doctors that were doing independently 3 different things. None of whom were doing the same. None of them were working together. And it was just this.
They were just throwing stuff at the wall.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was mom that actually fixed everything.
Bye.
Because the food was terrible, and I couldn't eat the food. And I couldn't swallow anyway, because my throat was 8 sizes too big. The doctors were all trying different medications, and they were trying to get me to, they had me on like antibiotics, and they gave me like Tylenol, Tylox, which was what Tylenol and codeine, I think, but, they were giving me all kinds of things to try and figure out what would help. And then finally, mom just started bringing me tomato soup and a thermos from home with some baby aspirin. And within 2 or 3 days, I was fine. Because at the time, you didn't give kids aspirin because there was a big paranoia about Reye syndrome.
Yeah, so, still a thing.
Yeah, but now they're a little better about. But they were really paranoid about it at that point because it was new. And so, but after a couple, 3 days of that, I started to get better. And so that was
each doctor took credit.
Oh, I'm sure they all did.
You got better after 3 days of that. But how long had you been in the hospital at that point?
8 days.
Yeah, you were in the hospital for a long time. You would never get away with that these days.
No. Oh, no.
But yeah. It was like a really unsatisfying episode of House.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, what's the go-to diagnosis on House? It's never right, but they always suggest it. I can't think of it now.
I don't remember.
But I talk to mom about it every now and then because I'll come across an article about Kawasaki's, and I just remember Dr. Monlux, and I just, in my head, even though I know it's not accurate, but in my head, the image I have of him is the same image that when I go and look in pictures on the internet of Gaddafi.
Oh, well, okay. But you have to admit that his name was Dr. Monlux. I mean, he had some things going against him to start with.
I think it was Monlux, but yes. Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a lot of good memories. I mean, I certainly fared better than the guy who was my roommate. Because he had his leg broken like 28 places.
I was going to say, yeah, because he was in a room with some kid that kept knocking out nurses' teeth.
Well, that happened at a different, because they moved me into his room later after, because, I can't believe we're talking about this. Because the first 2 nights I was there, where it was really bad, they had me in a room with a premature baby that was on like life support that eventually died.
Oof.
So I was like, okay. And then they moved me into his room, and he and his brother were, they were villagers. They were native, Alaska native. And, they were out snow machining, and his brother ran him over with the snow machine and broke his leg in 17 places. And then had to drive him like another 30 miles back to the village. So then they could get him airlifted to Anchorage where they could get his leg fixed. So,
okay. Now you realize that, if people were laying bets down on why one of the Anderson brothers would be in the hospital for a while, everybody would have taken the bet that we would have run one another over with a snow machine. Not on purpose, but you know, no one would have suggested mystery illness.
That's true. That's true.
Caused by carpet shampooers or something.
Well, that's the thing, that they still don't know what it was caused by. I mean, they don't know. They speculate it might have been the carpet, it might have been the cats, it might have just been, might have been around something that spawned my immune system to just go crazy.
You could have been tomato soup deficient.
Maybe, you know. Maybe I hadn't heard enough Men at Work.
And there you go. Or perhaps ducks singing parodies of folk songs.
Yeah, perhaps. Or maybe I didn't have enough Swedish crooners.
There you go.
At least you didn't have a pulmonary embolism like Glenn Headley.
Is that what happened?
I think so.
I hadn't heard anything about.
Yeah, they hadn't released anything when I was looking. Is that what was her cause of death?
I think so.
Yeah, that's scary stuff. Did she undergo some sort of procedure, or did she just throw a clot?
I don't know.
Because that's frightening. That could happen to anybody anytime.
I was just trying for a smooth segue back to the movie. You're not supposed to question me on it.
Okay, but is this part of Drew's dry humor? Should we add pulmonary embolism to the calendar? Or did you actually read that someplace?
No, I read that someplace.
Okay. Sorry. So back to the movie.
Well, before we do that, who else just passed away? Somebody else just passed away recently of leukemia.
Oh, I don't know.
Like an actor, you're thinking?
I think so.
Oh, Adam West?
Yeah, okay. That was it. Sorry, Adam West, okay. Batman.
See, I don't know he died of leukemia, but he had a good run.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, according to Time.com, Glenn Headley's husband said she died from pulmonary embolism complications.
Ah, bummer. That sucks.
She was filming a show for Hulu.
Ah, scary, scary, scary.
Oh, sorry. It was the Business as Usual cassette, by the way.
Oh, okay. All right. So that wasn't the first one, right? That was like the second one? Or was that the first one? What's on it? Who Could It Be Now? That stuff?
Yes.
Okay. I'm thinking, was it Cargo that was the second one? I don't know. Anyway. So, we haven't yet got to some of my favorite characters, including detectives Alvin Strayer, Jeff Daniels, and Wes Taylor, Eric Stoltz. And we have that uncomfortable massage parlor scene.
That man can lift a towel with no hands.
By the way, at the end of this movie, I don't know about you, but when Eric Stoltz has to wince in pain of being shot, he looks exactly like Michael J. Fox.
A little bit.
I saw Marty McFly right there. I'm like, okay, I know why they picked Michael J. Fox. But yeah, I love Jeff Daniels. He was like the darkest Jeff Daniels I've ever seen.
His hair should have gotten its own part.
Oh, it was great. Is that a hair pun?
Well,
Yeah, so these detectives... Jeff Daniels is a homicide a vice detective who is, he's a little on edge, and he got some weird news in the beginning.
A little?
You don't hear about. You don't know about it till the end, where we've already spoiled it, which hopefully if you're going to be, you know, discharged for, or suspended or whatever for psychiatric reasons, they wouldn't send you a letter saying, hey, within 2 days, come and bring your gun.
Yeah, that was one thing that was a little odd.
Yeah, they would bring you into a room, and you would not be expecting it, and they would take your gun.
Yeah, like, fork it over.
You are mentally unstable and no longer fit for duty. Come on by in the next 48 hours, please.
Exactly. Yeah. And then Eric Stoltz's character is he wants to be a homicide detective. And he's been going from detective branch to detective branch and has yet to hit the big time with homicide. And Jeff Daniels, you know, has no respect for him.
Because he's not a good cop.
You don't think?
No.
Okay. So they, besides having all this massage parlor talk that, and you know, that never resolves itself too. I mean, Alvin, because Wes accuses Alvin of being a racist, hating Asians.
Yeah, I don't hate Asians. I just don't like horrors.
He does not want a house of prostitution in the valley.
Exactly. That's his home. Yeah, so they end up, you know, they end up stumbling across Becky, who is now woken up the next morning next to her dead husband and runs out into the street covered in blood.
Mr. Splatterbrains.
Yeah, and then bumps into these detectives who assess the situation. And okay, you're right about him being Eric Stoltz being a bad cop because he starts messing with all the evidence. Even though he's being told, do not mess with all the evidence. I didn't realize, by the way, maybe because he's usually kind of a plays lighter, more comedic roles, but Jeff Daniels is a big guy.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, you put some scary cop, undercover detective hair on him, then yeah, he's an imposing guy. Eric Stoltz, not so much. But yeah, so they bump into Becky and find the homicide scene, and that's when this whole thing starts to, people start coming together.
Well, one of the things I loved about that scene when they're in the house is just the silent moment they had on the stairs when they were clearing the house with their guns drawn. And Jeff Daniels is like, what the fuck are you doing? He just gives him that look like, God damn it.
I like, actually, the later we meet some other detectives from the, actually a homicide detectives, including Keith Carradine, who I love to see always. And then Ada Maris, who I don't know, but she plays the other detective.
He wants it in Becky's pants.
Sure.
Even though the other detective's like calling him on it, he's like, no, I just admire her as an athlete.
Exactly. I'm not hitting on her.
Whatever.
Oh, really? I read that the exact opposite. She's like, are you hitting on her? And he's like, what do you think? I thought he was like, of course I was.
Yeah. And I love the fact that, you know, you don't get much time with the homicide detectives, but I love the fact that when they find the empty pack of cigarettes that they, you know, I know we're valley detectives, so we're not all that bright, but how stupid do these people think we are?
They're self-aware.
Yeah. So that's when we get to meet more of Helga. Helga is Charlize Theron's character, and she shows up to pick up Becky from the police station. And that's when we find out that Becky and Helga and James Spader all have a connection together because Becky has hired James Spader to kill her ex-husband, who has been like it went divorced and he got alimony from her.
Yeah. And she blames him for distracting her on her final ski run and costing her a medal.
Yes. What she did not anticipate is James Spader killing her husband while he was laying in bed with her.
Not part of the deal, apparently.
No, no. Also, because she didn't realize that was how it was going to happen, the money, the initial payoff of money, is she left in the house because she didn't anticipate having to run out of the house covered in blood. So James Spader has to go back to the house. And that's when all these people are going to converge.
And in this movie, Charlize Theron, she only wears either lingerie or a cat suit.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Or topless.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why she was in the movie. I mean, good for her. It turns out she's an excellent actor. But yeah, this was not, she was not hired to play Aileen Wuornos in this movie. She was strictly there to fill out a cat suit.
I just kept seeing Brigitte Nielsen.
Kinda. Because she is super tall. Yeah, so we, you know, it kind of runs down to the end. And, I mean, we don't really necessarily, even though we've sort of spoiled, you know, everybody kind of lives happily ever after, except for, well, okay. So, Jeff Daniels doesn't live happily.
All the bad guys get a bad ending. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And all the good guys pretty much
get a decent ending. Except for Terry Hatcher.
Yeah.
She's going to go train for Nagano.
Yes. But yeah, it's I thought it was fun. I like this movie quite a bit. Anything else on this? I want to talk about the Golden Raspberry Awards for 1996, but we can do that after Brother Jay gives us his verdict.
This was okay movie. It had some cute parts. I'd give it a C-.
Was it fun to see Glenn Headley in life?
It is. It's always it's always good to see her.
Yeah, I thought so too. Brother Drew, was it worth it?
Yeah, I mean, we barely talked about Glenn Headley, the whole reason we're watching the movie this week. She was really good in it.
She was the best part of this movie.
Yeah.
She was. She was really the heart and soul of the movie. She was the one you were really rooting for. This had a huge cast, and everybody was good or great in it. I don't think a Golden Raspberry for Terry Hatcher is fair. She wasn't asked to do much, but what she did was good. I mean, she had some really good scenes with Charlize Theron, including a fun little cat fight set to a song composed for the movie called Cat Fight.
Of course.
It's that kind of movie. But yeah, this movie is dated for sure, but in a fun way. Like, it doesn't... I guess it is specifically anachronistic, but it feels in place. It is a snapshot in time. It's fun to see James Spader with, like, a normal-sized head.
instead of, like, the shaved head?
Yeah, instead of, like, the bloated Leonardo DiCaprio-sized head.
Ah.
Sorry, I don't know why I took shots at both of those actors. That was uncalled for. But no, it was a fun movie. It's fun to see Danny Aiello playing sort of against type. The art dealer was great as sort of the hateable character, the one you'd love to hate. It was just twisty enough to stay interesting, but without getting too convoluted. But yeah, it's sort of a fun little mid-sized movie that you don't really get to see much anymore. So I think it's definitely worth it. It's got a little bit for everybody. It's got action. It's got some TNA. It's got some comedy. It's got some darkness, and it has a lot of light. It's got Glenn Headley.
Yeah, I agree.
She was great.
And she, like other characters too, like Marsha Mason and Paul Mazursky and stuff, the minor characters, they had respect for them. Like, they treated everybody with respect. They treated all the characters with respect. I like that too. Like, they could have cheesed out and given somebody kind of an unfair or a downer ending that didn't deserve it as a character, but they didn't. Everybody got to keep their dignity, which I liked.
Jeff Daniels kept his dignity?
No, it turns out he is the darkness.
Well, his ending was earned, though. I mean, he pulled a gun on Spawn, and then he yeah. He went back to his house and did the deed.
On Spawn?
Yeah.
See, the
that was the golfer.
Guy who played Spawn in the movie Spawn?
Yeah.
Have you seen the movie Spawn lately?
No.
It is horrible. I remember seeing that movie in the theater and I marveled at the title sequence. I thought it had the best titles of whatever year it was. That was like it took me out of the movie at first in the theater thinking, this is the greatest title scene ever. And then I think John Leguizamo is in a clown suit. Yeah, it's
yeah, no, he's gross.
Yeah. It was not a good movie. Not a good rewatch.
Sorry. The guy who played Spawn was not the one at the fence. He was one of the other golfers.
Oh, okay. I'd say this is a B movie for me. It was great. I'd watch it again.
Oh, and there was a cameo from Joe from Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
Lawrence Tierney.
Yeah. He was like, what, old man?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, so I liked it. I thought it was fun. Let me just tell you about the Golden Raspberry Wars in 1996 and tell you, Jason, maybe you might appreciate the value of this movie when you look at what else was happening in 1996.
Okay.
So some of these movies, by the way, I want to revisit. Not all of them, but...
Oh, God.
For instance, the movie that won Worst Picture was Striptease.
Yeah.
It beat Barbed Wire, Ed, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and The Stupids. Now, actors up for Worst Actor were Keanu Reeves in Chain Reaction, Adam Sandler in both Bulletproof and Happy Gilmore, and Sylvester Stallone in Daylight. But who won for Worst Actor? It was tied. Tom Arnold for The Big Bully, Carpool, and The Stupids, all three roles, tied with Pauly Shore in Biodome.
You cannot give Pauly Shore Worst Actor, because that's what he's trying for.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah. Let's see, Worst Actress nominees were Julia Roberts for Mary Reilly, which I didn't think she was a bad actress, it was just a bad movie. Duh. Yeah. Melanie Griffith in Too Much, which I don't even remember.
Don't remember.
Whoopi Goldberg in Theodore Rex, Bogus, and Eddie.
That was all in one year?
Yes. Pamela Anderson in Barbed Wire. But who won? It was Demi Moore for The Juror and Striptease. Worst Supporting Actor. Quentin Tarantino from Dusk Till Dawn. Steven Seagal in Executive Decision. Burt Reynolds in Striptease. Val Kilmer in The Ghost in the Darkness and The Island of Dr. Moreau. But the winner? Marlon Brando for The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Wait, that list is on the wrong side of history.
You think? I want to see Striptease, because Striptease was written... I mean, the book was by Carl Hiaasen, and it was good.
No.
Burt Reynolds was... I think Burt Reynolds had a scene where he covered himself in Vaseline. That sounds amazing. And Steven Seagal in Executive Decision, he was there only to be killed as a shock value.
Okay, yeah.
What was the first one?
Quentin Tarantino. He was also one of these shock things, because From Dusk Till Dawn turned into a whole different movie.
Yeah, he was...
Yeah. He was unlikable, but I think he did a good job being unlikable.
Yeah.
Of course, you could say he was playing himself, too.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Pretty sure he was.
So worst supporting actress, Terry Hatcher, which we already talked about. Also, Daryl Hannah in Too Much. I guess I don't know about the movie. Jamie Gertz in Twister.
Oh.
Faye Dunaway in The Chamber and Dunstan Checks In. But the winner? For worst supporting actress, Melanie Griffith in Mulholland Falls.
You're just making all these up.
Nope. Oh, no. It gets better. Worst screen couple. Matt LeBlanc and Ed, the mechanical monkey, in Ed. Marlon Brando and, quote, that darn dwarf in The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh, that's just rude.
Beavis and Butthead in Beavis and Butthead.
Oh. Come on.
Pamela Anderson's boobs in Barbed Wire. But the winner was Demi Moore and Burt Reynolds in Striptease. See? Worst director. Brian Levant for Jingle All the Way. John Landis for The Stupids. Stephen Frears for Mary Reilly. John Frankenheimer for Island of Dr. Moreau. But the winner, Andrew Bergman for Striptease. Worst screenplay. Let's see, I'll just run it. The Stupids, The Island of Dr. Moreau, Ed, Barbed Wire, and Striptease. Carl Hiaasen won that. Oh, sorry, Andrew Bergman won that. Worst new star. Sharon Stone as a Sirius in Diabolique and The Last Dance. The Friends cast members, Jennifer Aniston and She's the One, Lisa Kudrow and Mother, Ed LeBlanc and Ed, and David Schwimmer in The Pallbearer, Ellen DeGeneres and Mr. Wrong, I think that's on the right side of history, Beavis and Butthead in Beavis and Butthead, but the winner was Pamela Anderson in Barbed Wire. Let's see, the worst original song, Wherever There Is Love, which is the love theme from Daylight. I don't know that movie. Welcome to Planet Boom from Barbed Wire, written by Tommy Lee. But the winner was Pussy, 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 Whose Kitty Cat Are You from Striptease.
Oh, God.
And in the final category, Worst Written Film, grossing over $100 million. A Time to Kill, which I think it's not. I thought that was a good movie.
Yeah, with Matthew McConaughey, right?
Yep. And both Sandra Bullock and Ashley Judd. Also Samuel Jackson, but Mission Impossible. Independence Day.
Come on.
The Hunchback of Notre Dame Disney movie. But the winner, Twister, Michael Crichton.
Yeah.
So, which, by the way, I thought Twister was, you know, again, at the time, I haven't seen it since, but the Twister was all about effects and it knew what it was. Twister knew what it was. It was not selling itself as a serious drama.
It doesn't hold up. Don't because rewatch
the special
it.
Effects?
All of the above. It just, you will rewatch it. It's stay away. Your memory is better.
Okay.
Don't injure yourself.
Can we talk about the movie Too Much?
Sure.
Because it sounds amazing.
Please, tell us about Too Much.
So you're going to put it on the calendar?
Never. It is, it's starring Antonio Banderas, Melanie Griffith, and Daryl Hannah.
Oh.
I'm in.
And the plot is a young gallerist is in love with two sisters at the same time. In order to solve the problem, he decides to invent his own twin brother. So, sexy, smoldering, with his hair back in a ponytail, Antonio Banderas is trying to hook up with Melanie Griffith. And straight-laced, nerdy, wearing glasses with his long hair down, is trying to hook up with Daryl Hannah. But this movie has not only those three, it also has Danny Aiello, Joan Cusack, and Eli Wallach. Oh, so, and Austin Pendleton.
Wait, Melanie Griffith and Daryl Hannah are supposed to be sisters?
Yes.
Were they born like 40 years apart?
I don't know.
How old is Melanie Griffith?
She's 59.
How old is Daryl Hannah?
Daryl Hannah is 56.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, that's fascinating. When you described Antonio Banderas, I'm thinking, hey, he played both roles in that Joe Satriani video, Big Bad Moon.
Yeah, that's him.
Sergio.
Yeah, have fun. So any other housekeeping? That's good. Yeah, too much has got to be on the list at some point. So did you, I know Jason did. Drew, did you get to read Dougie's email?
I did. He's funny.
Dougie he is awesome.
He's fantastic. That guy can write an email.
We need to get him on. So even if we do it on a weekend when he's free and have to figure out the time zones, Dougie, dude, you need to come on. Pick a movie. Come on. Or
no pressure.
We'll have like a, or we can have like a 5-minute Dougie's Corner.
There you go. Oh, Dougie Digs It.
There you go.
Movie recommendations.
Yeah, maybe a film recommendation from the other side of the world.
Yeah, that might be the best way we can honor his patronage.
Yeah.
To do a movie he wants us to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, no, let me tell you.
So, Dougie, come on, because we know you're listening, and we appreciate all our listeners.
Wake up, Dougie.
Yeah, you probably just woke him up again.
Dougie, come to the light. No, just like, Dougie, give us your top 10 list.
Wait, don't come to the light. No, just stay alive. You have plenty to live for.
So, we're open to options, so. Yeah. But no, it was an amazing letter.
Yeah, I'm resisting the urge to read the entire thing again.
Oh.
Because I want to. Although, actually, I think maybe I will excerpt some of it. Maybe for next week, because he does have some actually specific feedback on both our 200 episode and GoldenEye, and The King's Speech.
Yes.
Also, Dougie, if you have a Kawasaki syndrome story, this is your time.
Jesus. I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
No,
jeez.
I wouldn't either.
Or if you want to talk about Superman 2, anytime.
Oh, that'd be great. Drew and Dougie can do that episode. It'd be fantastic to listen to.
Yeah, I could do that episode. I wouldn't even need to rewatch the movie. Neither would Drew.
That was the experience I had when I was listening to you guys talk about Murder by Death and High Anxiety.
So next week is Brokeback Mountain, a movie I have never seen.
I have also never seen it.
I like all the actors. Excellent. At least the four I can think of that are in it. If Lawrence Turney turns up, I will I'll be liking that too.
I think it'll be interesting to view it. I think especially for you guys, it'll be interesting to view it sort of being separate from the controversy at the time.
Like the shock value?
Mm-hmm.
Send your feedback to show@notinacreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.